she found him bleeding in the rain. No name, no shoes, no explanation for the silver runes carved into his chest like someone had tried to erase him from existence. Clarice was a herbalist, not a fool. She knew better than to bring a strange man into her cottage deep in Thornwood. She knew the old warnings, what her grandmother had whispered about the wild things that wore human skin when it suited them. She knew. She brought him in anyway. Because that was Clarice. She couldn't walk past suffering without bleeding for it. It was a gift. It was a curse. And tonight, it was going to change everything she thought she understood about her world, her bloodline, and herself. What she didn't know, what she could not have possibly known, was that the man shivering on her floor was not just some rogue wanderer. He was Aldred of Ravenswood, the exiled Fey Prince, the lost Wolf King, the sovereign heir to 4 centuries of dynasty, the man 2 kingdoms had quietly mourned and 1 man had meticulously erased Dot, the one the entire supernatural world thought was dead. And he had been looking for her. Specifically, her, for longer than she knew. And the Thornwood, the ancient, breathing, opinionated forest at her back, had been waiting for this exact moment. Tonight, everything was going to change. Her bloodline, her understanding of herself, her quiet, careful, modest life in the cottage at the forest's edge. Everything. If you've ever given your kindness to the wrong person at exactly the right time, subscribe before Clarice figures out what she's already walked into. Hit that bell. She would want you to. The Thornwood had rules. Every creature that lived near it knew them. Human, wolf-blooded, fey-touched, or something older and less easily named. They were not written anywhere. They didn't need to be. The forest communicated its own requirements through means more persuasive than ink. The way sounds stopped at the tree line when something was moving inside. The way certain paths that existed at dusk were simply gone by morning. The way travelers who went in looking for shortcuts sometimes came out days later on the opposite side of the forest, unable to account for the time and carrying leaves from trees that didn't grow anywhere near where they'd entered. The rules were these. You did not walk the Thornwood's edges after the moon rose copper. You did not follow the lights that drifted between the black-barked elder trees after rainfall. You did not make bargains with anything that offered you one without being asked. And you did not, under any circumstances, under any justification, no matter how compelling it seemed, invite into your home what the forest sent to your door. Clarice had grown up with those rules written into her bones like marrow. Her grandmother, Seraphel, had pressed them into her palms the way she pressed dried herbs, with deliberate intention, with enormous love, and with the quiet certainty of a woman who understood that the world contained teeth most people never saw until the moment those teeth were already closing. But Clarice was 24 now, and Seraphel had been 3 years in the ground, and the Thornwood was, she had mostly convinced herself, just a forest. A very old one. A strange one. One with a personality, perhaps, and opinions about weather, and what appeared to be a preference for certain kinds of music played near its edges on still evenings. But just a forest. She believed it well enough to leave her cottage door cracked on warm nights, letting in the particular cool pine and loam air that she'd been breathing her entire life and could not sleep without. Well enough to collect mushrooms from the soft belly of the forest without looking over her shoulder more than twice. Well enough to walk the near paths by lantern light when she had late patients in Ashenvale, the village 2 miles east, and couldn't spare the extra 30 minutes for the road. She had built a small, honest life at the forest's edge. Remedies and tinctures and house calls to Ashenvale, where the people paid her in eggs and gratitude and, when they remembered, coin. A garden that produced more than it should have given the rocky soil. A cottage that stayed warmer in winter than any structure without a working hearth should have managed. A reputation for knowing which herb to use for which ailment, with a precision that her neighboring herbalist, Oswin Trent, who had 3 decades on her and a library of formal texts, had long since stopped trying to explain or compete with. It was a quiet life. A careful life. A life she had shaped with intention, planted like her garden, tended like her silver bell vines. The kind of life that feels, in retrospect, like the calm stitched deliberately before the storm. The night everything unraveled began with rain. The kind that doesn't announce itself. No darkening horizon, no rising wind, no atmospheric warning. One moment, the evening air was dry and smelled of pine resin and cooling earth. The next, the sky simply opened, as if it had been waiting for exactly this moment to make its statement, and the rain came down in straight silver lines, dense and cold and indifferent. Clarice was returning from the Ashen Vale market with a basket of empty jars and a bruised sense of professional dignity. Old Renwick, who had been paying her in produce and evasion for 3 years, had offered 3 turnips and a suspicious look for a fever tonic that had taken her 2 hours to compound, and she had taken both the turnips and the look without comment, because Renwick was 73 and stubborn and the only person in Ashen Vale who grew the variety of root vegetables she needed for her winter stock. Aishi was composing a mental speech about fair compensation that she would never deliver when she saw him. At the edge of the thornwood, collapsed against the roots of the great split oak, the one that had grown in 2 trunks for as long as anyone could remember and that her grandmother had called a threshold marker, a place where the forest's attention pooled. Half folded into the mud, one arm draped over a root, face turned sideways against the bark, as though he had been walking the forest's edge and simply run out of whatever was keeping him upright. Her first thought was, traveler. Her second thought was, dead. Her third thought, the one that arrived as she was already moving across the road toward him, basket swinging, despite every grandmother-born instinct screaming its objections, was, those are not natural wounds. The slashes across his torso were too clean for claw marks, too deliberate and too precise for a blade she recognized. They ran in parallel sets, yes, which suggested something with multiple points, but the spacing was wrong for any animal she knew of, and the depth was uniform in a way that natural violence never was. And the symbols, overlaid on the wounds, or perhaps causing them, she couldn't tell. She couldn't look at directly. Every time her eyes tried to focus on them, her gaze slid sideways, like the marks actively refused to be witnessed. That, she knew, was old magic. Very old. The kind her grandmother had described in the grimoire's restricted pages as binding work. Magic designed to erase, to contain, to unmake. Someone had tried to unmake this man. She pressed 2 fingers to his throat regardless. The pulse was there. Strong, actually. Stronger than the rest of him suggested. But his skin temperature was wrong. Far too cold. Cold like water from the deep ground. Cold in a way that said his body was burning something other than ordinary heat to keep itself running. And when he exhaled, the breath came out in silver vapor. In the warm autumn air. Silver vapor. He was alive. He was absolutely not human. And Clarice was already, with the full knowledge of both those facts, deciding to bring him home. Grandmother's rules, she thought, looping his arm over her shoulders, staggering slightly under the weight of him. He was heavier than he should have been, heavier than a man his size should have been, as though he was denser than ordinary matter. I remember every single one of them. I am choosing, with full awareness and 0 apology, to ignore them all. He didn't wake for 3 days. Clarice told herself that was fine. Preferable, even. An unconscious, mysterious, supernatural stranger was significantly less complicated to manage than a conscious one. She had her work to do, her patients to see, her tinctures to finish before the first frost came down from the high thornwood slopes. An unconscious man in her back room required checking, tending, and the occasional adjustment of his position to prevent complications. A conscious one would require conversation. She told herself she was grateful for the delay. She tended his wounds with the same methodical attention she gave everything, cleaned the slashes first with boiled water and then with a salve of thorn moss and cold river clay that her grandmother had used for injuries she described as not entirely mortal in origin. Clarice had made it twice before, once for a wolf-blooded boy from the eastern settlements who'd come to her with claw marks that hadn't been made by any wolf, and once for a woman from the village of Caldenmere who'd walked into the Thornwood on a dare and come out 3 days later with something following her at a polite distance. She knew what these wounds were. She didn't say it out loud, because saying things out loud had a way of making them more real, and she was managing her reality carefully at present. She catalogued what she could about him the way she catalogued plants. Methodically, without sentiment, without the attachment that led to poor clinical decisions. Height, considerable, requiring her to extend the cot by wedging a folded blanket under the footboard. Build. Like someone had sculpted a man from gray stone and then breathed just enough warmth into him to make him passable at human. Hair. Dark as ink at midnight, tangled with twigs, and what appeared, on closer inspection, 2 candles worth of careful looking, to be genuine silver dust, the kind that gathered in fey-touched spaces after major workings. His face was the harder observation to make clinically. Not beautiful, exactly, though it was that, in the way of things that weren't designed for beauty, but achieved it through structure. More than beautiful, authoritative, at rest and in unconsciousness, in a way that made her think of old stone. The kind of face that had been making decisions for a very long time, the kind that had stopped caring about approval and moved on to something more interesting. She catalogued his hands last, because his hands were the strangest thing. The left, calloused in the specific pattern of a lifelong fighter, knuckles, inner palm, the web between thumb and forefinger. The right, smoother but bearing along 2 fingers a tracery of world ink that was neither tattoo nor scar. It sat on the surface of the skin and below it simultaneously, shifting faintly when the candlelight moved, like something written in a medium that didn't fully exist in this world. She had seen illustrations of fey lineage marks in her grandmother's grimoire, the hereditary ink that the old bloodlines carried in their skin the way humans carried eye color. She had thought they were illustrations. Don't ask questions you don't want the answers to, Clarice. She asked them anyway, out loud, quietly, to the empty room and the rain on the window and the dried thorn moss bundles hanging from the rafters. The cottage had always felt like it listened. Tonight it felt like it knew something she didn't and was weighing whether to share it. Who are you? What did that to you? What are you running from? What found you? How did you end up at my particular door, against my particular tree, on my particular road? The cottage gave no answers. The man on the cot breathed. On the second night, he murmured something in his sleep. She was at the workbench across the room, grinding the last of the autumn fennel by candlelight, when it happened. One word, low and fractured by 3 days of no water, spoken in a language she'd never heard, but felt somehow in the base of her sternum, the way she felt thunderstorms before they arrived. Spoken with such absolute conviction, such utter certainty, that it carried the weight of an oath even barely conscious, even broken open by injury and unconsciousness. It landed in her chest like a stone dropped into still water. Ripples. Outward and outward, and then stillness, and the night, and the sound of her own careful breathing. She set down the pestle, looked at him from across the room for a long moment, really looked, past the clinical inventory, past the careful management. You are going to be a problem, she thought. Every single thing about you is going to be a problem. I can already tell. He woke on the third morning, not the way humans woke, the slow surfacing, the confusion, the blink and gather. He simply opened his eyes between one breath and the next, and they were silver. Not gray silver, not pale silver. Silver the way the inside of a freshly cut piece of the metal looked, liquid and bright and slightly dangerous. And they fixed on her face with a precision that said he had perhaps not been entirely unconscious for some portion of the previous night. He'd been listening. She held the gaze steadily because she was Clarice, and she did not look away from things. You should not have brought me here, he said. His voice was wrecked from 3 days of silence, low and rough-edged, carrying an accent she couldn't place against any region she knew. You were dying in my road, Clarice said, setting down her mortar with a deliberate small sound. I had limited options and no guarantee the forest would do anything useful with you. He sat up. In one motion, despite 3 days unconscious and wounds that should have had him flat for a week, sat up with the controlled economy of someone whose body remembered how to move even when the rest of him had forgotten where he was. He looked at the room, the door, the windows, the charms above the door, which he looked at longest. How long? 3 days. You're welcome. Something crossed his face. Not quite gratitude. It had the shape of gratitude, but the weight of something older and more complicated. Something that had been waiting a long time, waiting to feel this particular thing, and wasn't sure what to do with it now that it had arrived. I need to leave. Your chest is still knitting. The binding marks are still active. You have what appears to be a curse fragment embedded in your shoulder that I haven't been able to fully address because I wasn't entirely sure what I was addressing, and I don't work blind. Sit down. A pause. Very brief. Very weighted. You don't understand the risk you've taken by... Sit down, she said. I understand the risk. I made a choice. You can argue with my choices when you're not a liability to yourself and everyone near you. Sit down. He sat down. She didn't realize until later, until much, much later, when she understood the full weight of what he was. How extraordinary that was. How many things he could have done instead. How many centuries of authority and absolute sovereignty made sitting down at a mortal woman's instruction something that shouldn't have happened. How the wolf in him, the fae in him, every hereditary layer of his existence should have simply refused. He sat down because she told him to. And neither of them knew yet, not fully, not consciously, what that meant. What it had always meant. His name, he told her on the fourth day, was Aldred. No family name offered, no village, no origin, no context. Just Aldred, spoken with the flat finality of someone who had decided what information was being shared and would not be moved on the boundaries. Clarice accepted this the way she accepted most things, outwardly, without visible reaction, while internally cataloging it alongside everything else she was building a picture from. She didn't push. She'd grown up beside a forest that had taken 3 people from Ashenvale in her lifetime for asking the wrong questions in the wrong places, and she understood that some information offered itself in its own time or not at all. Pushing before it was ready served no one. She had watched her grandmother handle impossible things with patience and silence and the calm certainty that the truth always, eventually, wanted to be known. So she focused on what she could manage. Food, hydration, the careful balance of his temperature, which ran too cold in a way that seemed less like illness and more like his baseline, and the ongoing work of the thorn moss salve on wounds that were closing at a rate she was tracking partly from professional interest and partly because the rate was medically extraordinary and she needed to understand it. He healed fast. Faster every day. Not the fast of a strong constitution. The fast of a body operating by rules that weren't entirely biological. He submitted to her tending with the air of someone profoundly unaccustomed to receiving care and entirely unable to explain why he wasn't refusing it. He was compliant in the way of things that could very easily be otherwise, a compliance that felt chosen, specific, like he was making a decision to allow it each time, rather than simply defaulting to it. He watched her constantly, not threateningly, not with predatory intent, though there was something predatory in the architecture of his attention, the complete, unwavering focus of something that was always tracking its environment. He watched her move around the cottage with those silver eyes, the way the thornwood watched her sometimes, as though she was something to be understood, catalogued, taken seriously. He watched the charms above the door, the longest of all. Seraphil's warding charms, dried thorn bell and iron-threaded cord, knotted in patterns her grandmother had learned from someone she never named and taught to Clarice with the instruction, "These are not decorative." Aldred looked at them like they were familiar. Thornwood warding. he said on the fourth morning, not questioning, simply naming it, the way you'd name something you'd encountered before in a different form. My grandmother's work, Clarice said without looking up. She was particular about the knot sequence, said it made a difference, a silence that felt carefully constructed. She was right, he said, and then quieter. She was wise. Past tense, not condolence past tense, the way people spoke of the dead when they were being kind. Acknowledgement past tense. The past tense of someone confirming a known fact about a person they had perhaps known themselves. Clara set down her pestle. She did not turn around. She looked at the wall above her workbench, at the neat row of labeled jars, at the winter light coming through the small window above the shelf. She did not ask. Not yet, she told herself. Wait. Let it come to you. Over the next several days, a domestic rhythm established itself with a naturalness that she found both comforting and suspicious. Clarice worked. Aldred healed. He was quiet in the manner of something that could be extraordinarily loud if it chose, a coiled stillness, a leashed quality that she felt in the room even when she wasn't looking at him, the way you felt weather changing before the sky showed it. He didn't eat much, but he ate everything she offered without complaint or negotiation, which she noted because she had expected negotiation. He helped without being asked and without making a production of it, splitting the wood she'd been ignoring since early autumn, mending the shutter hinge that had been bothering her for months, pulling dead growth from the garden beds in the cold morning with the systematic thoroughness of someone who had been maintaining things for a very, very long time. Centuries, she thought, watching him move through the garden with purpose. He moves like someone who has been tending things for centuries. She pushed the thought down. She was good at pushing thoughts down. It was a skill she'd developed in a childhood spent at the edge of a forest that was always offering information she wasn't ready to receive. They argued, because of course they did. He wanted to leave before he was ready. She objected. Medically and practically every time he raised it. He had opinions about her herb storage that were, she had to privately admit, not wrong, but were delivered with the confidence of someone who had absolute authority somewhere and couldn't entirely suppress it even when they were trying to be deferential. She had opinions about his habit of standing at the window in the hour before dawn in complete silence, watching the tree line with an expression that was half vigilance and half something she couldn't name. What are you looking for? Nothing that has found us yet. That is not a reassuring answer. It wasn't meant to reassure you. It was meant to be accurate. Accurate and reassuring are not mutually exclusive. You could try for both. The ghost of something crossed his face. Not a smile. Not quite. Something that might have been a smile in a man who had more practice at them. But underneath the friction, underneath the careful management of what was being said and not said, something else was accumulating. Quieter. More dangerous, in the specific way of things that were only dangerous, because you couldn't stop them once they started. A comfort she couldn't name or reasonably explain. The way he handed her things before she realized she needed them. The way the cottage felt different when he was in it. Fuller somehow, as though the room itself was doing something slightly different with the air and light when he occupied it. The way her silver bell plants, the difficult ones on the east-facing windowsill, began producing new shoots in the wrong season. She noticed. She hated noticing. She was a sensible woman. She had built her sensible life with considerable effort, and she was not going to complicate it by developing feelings for a wounded supernatural stranger with silver eyes and deliberate silences who was clearly, clearly fleeing something very large and very determined. She noticed anyway. On the fifth day, she found him in her herb garden, crouched at the edge of the silver bell patch, the rarest thing she grew. 3 years of careful cultivation from two small cuttings that had cost her more in favors to a Caldenmere trader than she liked to remember. His hand was above the flowers, not touching, hovering perhaps 2 inches above the nearest cluster of blooms, and the flowers were leaning toward him, leaning, slowly and completely, and without ambiguity, the way sunflowers tracked the sun across the sky. the way compass needles found true north in the presence of something magnetized. Every stem curved toward his hovering hand with the patient certainty of plants that knew which direction life was coming from, as if they recognized him, as if they had been waiting for him to come close enough. She said his name once, quietly. He stood and turned in one motion that was too fast and too fluid for a man 10 days out from serious injury, and on his face was an expression she hadn't seen before. Not guilt, exactly. Something more complex than guilt. The expression of someone who has been caught not committing a crime, but revealing a truth they weren't ready to offer yet. "I wasn't," he started. "What are you?" she asked, and this time she wasn't asking lightly. She was asking with the full weight of 5 days of observation behind it, the flowers leaning toward his hand, the silver breath, the wounds that healed wrong, the charms he recognized, the name he said like a native speaker of a language she only knew existed in theory. He looked at her for a long moment. The morning light came through the garden gate and caught the silver of his eyes, and she thought, not for the first time, that he looked less like a person and more like a question she didn't yet have the vocabulary to ask. "Complicated," he said. One word. Quiet. And despite the simplicity of it, or perhaps because of it, it landed with the weight of a complete and honest answer. It was, she would come to understand, the most truthful thing he'd said to her yet. The first undeniable sign came in the form of a wolf, not a small one. Not the gray wolves that occasionally moved through the Thornwood's outer territories in winter, which Clarice had made a comfortable peace with over years of near encounters and mutual respect. This was something else, a creature the size of a young horse, coat as black as the interior of the Thornwood at new moon, sitting at the tree line with the composed patience of something that had been there before and intended to return. It appeared on the seventh morning, in the mist, just after dawn, and sat at the exact point where the Thornwood's edge met the cottage lane. It didn't pace. It didn't advance. It simply sat and looked at the cottage with amber eyes that held an intelligence so specific and so organized that the word animal became genuinely insufficient. It stayed for perhaps 20 minutes. Then it stood, turned without haste, and walked back into the Thornwood without a sound. Clarice had watched it from the window. Aldred had been standing behind her. She'd heard him come to stand there, had felt the shift in the room's quality that always accompanied him. And when the wolf turned and left, she heard him exhale slowly. Not with relief, with something more like resignation. "Friend or threat?" she asked, eyes still on the empty tree line. "Neither. A scout." "Whose scout?" A pause. "Mine." The word arrived in the room with the absolute certainty of a truth that had been waiting for the right moment to announce itself, and Clarice felt it settle into the larger picture she'd been building. One more piece clicking into a configuration she was beginning to be able to see. She turned. He was watching the tree line, not her. "You have scouts," she said. Not a question. "I have loyalists. People, and otherwise, who didn't believe I was dead. Who've been looking. That one has been circling the Thornwood boundary for 3 weeks. It found me when I crossed the edge 9 days ago, and it's reporting back to someone." "Yes, to people who will now know I'm here, which means others will know too, including people who want you dead." "Including people who want me dead," he confirmed quietly. She processed this. "Then, how many people think you're dead?" "Most of a kingdom." She went and put the kettle on. It was either that or stand in the middle of the room cataloging what she was feeling, and cataloging her feelings was something Clarice did at the workbench with a task in her hands, not standing still. Over the days that followed, the signs continued to accumulate in the unhurried way of things that had been there all along and were only now consenting to be noticed. A crow appeared on the garden gate on the eighth morning and spoke 3 distinct syllables. Not cawing, speaking, in a voice that was a crow's voice and something else layered beneath it. The syllables were from the same language Aldred had murmured in his sleep that second night, and Clarice caught them before she could decide whether to, and held them in her memory like seeds waiting for context. A circle of fey silver mushrooms appeared overnight along the cottage path, small luminous caps, appearing in a ring so geometrically perfect it made the concept of coincidence feel embarrassed. Her grandmother had drawn this in the grimoire, waymarkers, used by the high courts to indicate acknowledged territory or flag a person of significance. The mushrooms were facing the cottage door. Then came Decimus. He arrived on the ninth day, announced by the particular quality of silence that preceded him, the birds stopping, the wind dropping, the specific hush of a place that recognized predatory authority and made space for it. He looked like a man of consequence, tall, immaculately dressed in traveling clothes that had seen no actual travel, with the kind of controlled stillness that lived in the same family as Aldred's stillness, but felt fundamentally different. Aldred's stillness was natural. Decimus was constructed. He knocked with the confident rhythm of someone for whom doors had always opened without delay, and Clarice answered before Aldred could reach the hall. "Good morning," he said, and smiled the smile that didn't reach its destination. "I'm traveling through on behalf of court business, and I wonder if you might help me. I'm looking for someone. A traveler, perhaps recently injured. Tall, dark-haired. He may have come through this area." She saw the court tattoos. Caught the edge of them where his collar shifted, the precise geometric ink of the Fey noble class, the deep bloodline markings that the high courts burned into their enforcers as both identity and instrument. Her grandmother had shown her the illustrations in the grimoire's sealed section and said, "If you ever see these on a man standing at your door, be very careful what you say and mean every word of it. Don't let them in," Seraphel's voice, years old and absolutely current in her memory. Not without understanding precisely what they want and who sent them and what it will cost you. "I haven't seen anyone matching that description," Clarice said pleasantly. "There's a fair bit of road through here, though. The village of Ashenvale, 2 miles east, might have more information for you." Decimus's smile remained exactly where it was. His eyes, however, moved, a precise sweep past her shoulder into the visible interior of the cottage, measuring, calculating, noting what was and wasn't present with the efficiency of someone who had done this a very great number of times. She shifted her weight slightly forward, into the doorframe. "The thornwood can be unpredictable for those unfamiliar with it," he said. Still pleasant, still with that smile. "I'd hate to think of anyone coming to harm through misplaced sentiment, misplaced loyalty, you understand." The threat was not even particularly disguised. It was delivered with the confidence of a man who had never had to disguise his threats because no one had ever called him on them. "I'll keep that in mind," Clarice said. "Safe travels." She shut the door. She turned and found Aldred in the hallway entrance. He was standing in the exact posture of someone who had been one decision away from stepping outside and had chosen not to, and the expression on his face was the most complex thing she'd seen on it yet, relief and something fiercer and underneath both of those, an emotion she recognized but hadn't expected. Something that looked, quietly and comprehensively, like awe. "You lied to a Fey Court enforcer," he said, very quietly. "He was rude first," she said, and hung her empty basket on its hook. A beat. Two. Then, barely above audible, "Clarice?" She went still. It was the first time he had said her name. She had not given it to him, which meant he'd known it before she introduced herself, had known it through means she hadn't examined yet, and the fact that it sounded like that coming from him, careful and deliberate and reverent, like something he had been holding carefully for a long time and was only now allowing himself to say out loud, made the back of her neck prickle. "I need to tell you something," he said. She breathed. Once. Slow. "I know," she said. "I've been waiting for you to decide you were ready. Take your time. But understand that Decimus arriving means we don't have unlimited time to take." He looked at her for a long, long moment. Like something surfacing, she thought. Like something coming up from very deep water. He told her in pieces. Not all at once. Not the way confessions sometimes arrived in torrents. everything released at once because the dam had simply failed. He told her carefully, "The way you dismantled something that had been load-bearing for a long time, removing one piece, waiting, checking that the structure still stood, then removing another." She sat on the workbench stool and listened without interrupting. This was a skill she had developed over years of patients who needed to tell her things before they could let her help them, and she employed it now with the same quality of attention, complete, patient, undramatic. He was Aldred of Ravenswood, eldest son and heir of the Feywolf dynasty that had held the Thornwood border territories, the pack lands of the eastern reaches, and the Fey court seat at Ravenswood for four consecutive centuries. His bloodline ran in two directions simultaneously, from his father's line, the ancient High Fey nobility, the kind that had existed long enough to become part of the landscape itself, from his mother's, the hereditary Wolf Alpha strain that made the shifter packs of the East respond to the Ravenswood name the way birds responded to the change of season, instinctively, without being taught. He was, by every right of blood and succession, both the High Fey Prince and the Wolf King. He had been exiled 18 months ago. Not officially. There was no proclamation, no formal disgrace. Men like Decimus were too careful for official proclamations, which created records and records created accountability. It had been done through the patient, systematic destruction of everything that supported him. His allies' loyalty purchased away, one by one. His betrothal dissolved through a manufactured scandal that he'd had no advance knowledge of and no opportunity to defend against. His court seat stripped in a procedural maneuver so technically correct that contesting it required first acknowledging that the procedure existed, which required acknowledging the procedure had been legitimate, which was a trap with teeth on both ends. His lands placed in provisional trust under the court enforcer who had orchestrated all of it. Decimus. Aldred said the name the way you'd say the name of a poison you'd managed to survive. He is meticulous. He spent 3 years positioning himself before he made his first move. I didn't understand what he was doing until it was almost finished. What distracted you? She asked. He was quiet for a moment. A prophecy. One the court officially dismisses and privately uses to make every significant decision it has made for 200 years. What does it say? He looked at her then, directly, fully, for the first time since he'd started talking. And the moonlight coming through the cottage window was doing something specific to his eyes, turning the silver towards something closer to starlight, and she thought with the rational part of her that observed things even under pressure that he was afraid. Not of the prophecy, of how she was going to hear it. A mortal-born woman of the old herbalist lines, Thornwood raised. Of the blood of someone who made a pact directly with the forest, not with its spirits, not with its creatures, but with the forest itself. She would be born carrying what the forest gave her ancestor, and she would be the one who either broke the exile or confirmed it permanently. The fire crackled. The silverbell vines outside the window moved without wind. Clarice thought about her grandmother, about the grimoire's sealed pages, about the pact mark she'd found once on the inside cover in Seraphel's precise handwriting, marks she'd been too young to read properly and too old to pretend she hadn't seen. You believe that's me? I know that's you. How long have you known? The pause was a fraction of a second too long. Precisely a fraction. The pause of someone who had prepared for this question and was using the preparation to be honest. Since before I came to the Thornwood boundary, she stood up. Walked to the window. Put her back to him and looked at the dark tree line and the copper moon and the world outside, which had been perfectly quiet a minute ago and was now full of things she hadn't known were present. The anger arrived cleanly, the way the best anger did, not hot and scattered but focused and useful. He had come here knowing her name, knowing what she was, what she represented, what she was to him according to an old prophecy that neither of them had been consulted on. He had walked into her road and let her bring him in and care for him and tend his impossible wounds for 9 days without saying a word. The anger was completely legitimate. She felt it fully and without apology. And underneath it, underneath, running alongside it like a second current in the same river. Something else. The silver bell flowers that had leaned toward him. The cottage that had breathed differently when he arrived. Her grandmother's wards, Seraphel's precise, careful, no-nonsense wards that were designed to protect and alert and deflect, which had not triggered when she brought him in. Not a flicker. Not a whisper of activation. Because they had recognized him and found him permissible. She built those to protect me, Clarice thought, her hands braced on the windowsill. She built them specifically to protect me. And they let him in. The forest let him in. Grandmother let him in. Everything that has ever been asked to protect me recognized him and opened the door. Was the injury genuine? She asked, still facing the window. Her voice was level. She was proud of that. Yes, he said, and even without seeing his face, she could hear the particular quality of honesty in it, the flatness of something stated simply because it was true, not because it served anything. The exile curse is real. What Decimus bound into it is real. I was genuinely dying. I had perhaps 12 hours when you found me. Then how did you end up at my door specifically? A pause, heavier this time. I was making my way toward the Thornwood boundary. The prophecy named a location as much as a person. I was coming to find it, to find you, because the curse was accelerating and I was running out of time and options. I didn't engineer landing at your feet, but I would be lying if I said I wasn't heading in your direction. She breathed. And what I did, the way I treated the wounds, the instincts I followed. No human herbalist should have been able to approach those wounds, let alone slow them. The salve you used, the sequence you used it in, the instinct to add the cold river clay at the third application, those are not things written in any human medical text. You couldn't have learned them from a book, Clarice. My grandmother taught me. Your grandmother, he said softly, made a pact with the Thornwood when she was 23 years old. Not with a creature of the forest, with the forest itself, with the living intelligence that runs through its roots and has been there since before the Fae Courts existed. She asked it for knowledge, for the ability to protect her bloodline against what the world contained that ordinary knowledge couldn't address. The forest gave her everything she asked for. And when she was gone, it passed what it had given her down the line. To you. The fire in the hearth was very out of season. By weeks. One flower opening, then another, white and luminous in the dark, each bloom catching the moonlight like a small lantern, spreading down the vines until the whole exterior of the cottage window was framed in impossible light. Not asking, not warning, confirming. Everything is choosing sides, Clarice thought. Everything that can has already chosen. The question is whether I'm ready to choose too. Her grandmother made a pact with the forest itself. Clarice was never ordinary. She was built for this. Subscribe. Because the next piece of this story is the one that changes everything. She didn't sleep that night. Sleep felt like an absurd concept given what had been placed in front of her, so she sat at the workbench instead, in the particular quality of silence that followed a significant revelation, and did what she always did with things she didn't know how to hold. She thought about them methodically from every angle she could find until they became something she could work with. She went back through every memory of her childhood with new eyes. It was an unsettling exercise. Every small miracle she'd attributed to luck, or her grandmother's teaching, or the particular quality of the soil around the Thornwood, the time she'd been lost in the forest at 8 years old, and found her way back, not by retracing her steps, but by following some instinct she couldn't name that had never been wrong. The plants that responded to her hands differently than to anyone else's. The illnesses that improved faster under her care than under Oswin Trent's despite his 3 extra decades of experience and considerably thicker reference library, all of it reassembled into a pattern that was neither luck nor skill, but something she'd been carrying without a name for it her entire life. What did you make me into, grandmother? She thought, not with anger, but with the complicated love of someone discovering that the person they trusted most had protected them by not telling them the full truth. What did you give me that you never told me you were giving? Aldred slept in the chair by the fire. She watched him from across the room in the intervals between thought, the steady rise and fall of his breathing, the way his face looked different in sleep, the authority dialed back just enough to reveal what was underneath it. He looked younger. He looked, for the first time, like someone who had perhaps been very tired for a very long time and was only now, in this particular cottage with these particular wards, actually resting. She thought about the prophecy, about the specific and terrible thing it implied, that she had been made, or at least shaped, for this. That her grandmother's pact had produced her the way a garden produced something specific when planted with specific seeds, that her arrival in this story was not a coincidence or a choice but a construction. She thought about Decimus at her door with his court tattoos and his pleasant threats, and the practiced ease with which he operated, and what it would mean if Aldred went back to that court without every possible advantage. She thought about the mate bond, because she had read about it in the grimoire, in the section Seraphel had marked with three separate bookmarks, and the marginal note, "Understand this before you need to." The Feywolf version, the Ravenswood version specifically, which was different from the territorial bonds of lesser wolf lines. It didn't compel. It didn't override. It was a recognition. Deep and cellular and not particularly interested in your personal timeline. And then a door, and the door waited. Not asked, she thought, and felt the full irony of it. Chosen. When Aldred woke in the gray hour before dawn, he found her still at the workbench. He looked at her with an expression so carefully arranged to show nothing that it showed everything, the particular transparency of a man who has prepared himself to hear something he is afraid of hearing and is using all his considerable discipline to look like he hasn't. He was afraid of what she was going to say. Something about this, the fear underneath all of it, the genuine vulnerability of a fey king in a herbalist's chair, afraid of a 24-year-old woman's assessment of him, settled something in her, gave her a handhold. "I have questions," she said. "I know. Specific ones, not polite ones. I know, ask them." "The mate bond," she said, directly, the way she asked everything. "The Ravenswood version. I know what it is. The grimoire was thorough on the subject. Is that what this is? What I've been feeling since you came here? Is that the bond?" He was very still, the stillest she'd seen him. "Yes. And you knew it was here before you came." "I knew the bond existed. I knew the prophecy named a fated mate. I didn't know..." He stopped. "What?" "I didn't know it would feel like this," he said, quietly, as though the admission cost something. "I had prepared myself to meet a stranger. Someone significant by prophecy. I was not prepared to arrive, half dead, and find someone who already felt familiar. Not recognized. I hadn't met you. But familiar, like something I'd been missing without knowing what it was." Clarice waited. She was very good at waiting. "I hadn't expected to understand who you were before I knew you. That isn't in any account of the bond I've ever read. That isn't how it's supposed to work." "Maybe the prophecy made its own adjustments," she said. She was trying for dry. She was not entirely achieving it. "Can you tell the difference?" she asked. The real question. The one she'd been building toward. "Between wanting me and needing me for the curse? Between the bond and the prophecy? Are those the same thing to you, or are they separate?" He took a breath. "Slow. They are entirely separate," he said. "The curse breaking, I can feel it. It has a quality like a physical mechanism, like something unlocking. Clinical, detached. What I feel for you has none of that quality. It doesn't feel like a necessity. It feels like the first genuine choice I've made in 18 months, perhaps longer. I want you to know the difference because I need you to know that one is circumstance and one is entirely mine, freely." She looked at him for a long moment in the gray pre-dawn light. Then she got up from the workbench stool, crossed the room, and put her hand against the side of his face. Cool, as always, like touching the surface of still water. And kissed him once. Carefully. The way she did everything. With attention, with intention, knowing exactly what she was choosing. He made a sound that was nothing a human man would make, low and involuntary and absolutely honest, and the mate bond responded like the silver bell flowers responding to moonlight, blooming through her system with the sudden irreversible certainty of something that had been waiting only for permission. When she pulled back, the symbols on his chest had changed. They were lighter. Not gone. Not yet. But visibly, measurably lighter. As though the binding work was releasing one layer at a time. The exile curse, she said. You started breaking it, he said. His voice had a quality she hadn't heard in it before, wrecked in a way that had nothing to do with wounds and everything to do with being met. Okay, she said after a moment. Okay? That's my answer. To the question you were afraid to ask. Okay. I'm choosing this. Don't make it strange by being shocked about it. Something happened to his face that she thought might be, finally, a real smile. Surprised and unguarded and entirely undone, the way sunlight looked finding a crack in stone after a long winter. Like he had no practice with being chosen, she thought. Like it had never occurred to him that he might be. Decimus returned on the 12th day, and this time he did not come alone. 4 riders, court-marked and wolf-blooded, dressed in the gray and silver livery of Ravenswood, which was wrong. Ravenswood's colors had been officially changed under Decimus's provisional stewardship. The assembly had ratified it. Gray and silver was the old livery. The bloodline, livery. The colors that meant loyalty to Aldred's line specifically and not to whoever happened to be holding the seat. Someone had refused to change their colors. 4 someones. Aldred saw them from the window. Claris watched what happened to his face, a rapid, quiet reorganization, like watching a man remember who he was after a long period of having been required to be someone else. The exhaustion that had lived around his eyes since he woke lifted slightly. His posture changed, not more aggressive, not more tense, more settled, more occupied, as though some part of him that had been suspended waiting returned to its rightful place. He went outside before Claris could reach the door. The effect was immediate and involuntary. The horses shied from something they felt before they processed it. 2 of the 4 riders went half forward in their saddles with their heads bowing in the instinctive wolf recognition of an alpha, not trained deference, but the bone-deep kind that bypassed decision and simply happened the way breathing happened. The 3rd dismounted entirely and went to 1 knee in the mud. No hesitation, no calculation. Just, he appeared, and the knee went down, as though the body had been waiting for the chance. Decimus alone sat his horse without moving, looked at Aldred across the lane with the expression of a man confirming an equation rather than encountering a surprise. You, he said. Flat. Certain. Me, said Aldred, and there was nothing performative in it. The curse was supposed to partially lifted. Actively lifting further, I thought it was information you should have sooner rather than later. Decimus's attention shifted past him to the cottage, to Claris in the doorway, and she watched him look at her. Watched him look at her with the specific focus of someone performing a rapid and comprehensive reanalysis, updating everything he'd calculated on the basis of new data. What she saw in his face was not surprise. Surprise would have been manageable. What she saw was recognition, the deep kind, the kind that meant he had known about her, had known she was a variable, had simply underestimated the timing. The herbalist, he said softly, as though completing a sentence he'd been holding for some time. I should have moved sooner. I knew the prophecy. I thought I had more time before it activated. Aldred's voice, when he responded, had taken on a quality Claris hadn't heard from him before. Not louder, not more aggressive, simply fuller. The full weight of 4 centuries of sovereign authority, unguarded, undiluted, occupying the air around him with the particular density of something that was not performing and not requesting, but simply stating what was true. She is not your variable to account for, Decimus. She is not your data point or your timeline to manage. We are finished here. Decimus smiled. It was, Claris thought, the most dangerous thing she had seen him do. Not because it was malicious, it barely qualified as a smile. Because it meant he still had something he hadn't played. Not quite finished, he said. You see, I anticipated your survival. I anticipated the curse being partially addressed. I'm a thorough man, Aldred. You know this. So while you were recovering, I filed a sovereignty challenge with the full assembly, a binding on the title itself. The kingship requires, under the old compact, a return before the full court, in person, verified sovereign, within 60 days of the challenge being filed, or the provisional arrangement converts to permanent. He produced a sealed document from his coat, held it up without moving to deliver it. The challenge was filed 28 days ago. You have 32 days remaining, and the full assembly convenes, as scheduled, in 6 days. The silence stretched. You planned for my recovery, Aldred said. I plan for all contingencies. Come to court, present yourself before the assembly, reclaim your title through the proper mechanisms, the sovereignty proofs, the lineage acknowledgement, all of it. Or decline to appear, and Ravenswood passes to me under a filing so legally clean that no court in 6 kingdoms could contest it. He turned his horse with the practiced ease of a man who had done everything he came to do, and the 3 riders followed. The 4th, the one who had knelt, looked at Aldred once more before turning. His expression held an apology that lived in the eyes because there was no other safe place to put it. Aldred stood in the road and watched them until they were gone. Claris watched Aldred. When he turned, his face was doing the controlled thing, the careful management of everything visible, but she had been watching his face for 12 days and she was past the surface layer now, underneath the control, the weight of it. All of it at once. The title, the land, the people, the 4 centuries of bloodline obligation. The understanding that every move Decimus had made had been laid weeks or months in advance, and that recovering from the curse had only brought him to the beginning of a different battle. 6 days, she said. 6 days, he confirmed. What happens if you don't appear? He listed it without inflection. Ravenswood. The Packlands, the border territories, the Fey court seat, the 4 centuries of stewardship and treaty and protection that his bloodline had built, given permanently to the man who had destroyed him through procedure. Claris looked at the sky, pale autumn blue, crossed with birds heading south. And you're thinking about going alone, she said. I'm thinking that this is not your fight, and that I have already cost you enough. How much of the curse remains? He looked at her. 2 days, perhaps 3, with... Then we have time, she said. She walked back inside. He followed and found her already at the workbench, her grandmother's most serious compound laid out in front of her, the one Seraphil had marked in the margin with 3 exclamation points, an underline, and the note... Do not use unless you are completely, irreversibly certain, the most potent healing work in the entire grimoire. The one that required the herbalist to put her own energy into it. You don't have to come, he said carefully from the door. This isn't your obligation. She looked up at him over the mortar and the jars. I know I don't have to. I know it's not my obligation. Ask me again what I'm choosing. He was quiet for a long moment, looking at her in the cottage that had been her grandmother's and was hers now, amid the tools of her trade and the inheritance she'd only just understood the full shape of. Thank you, he said, quietly, like it was something he had little practice saying and was therefore saying it with particular care. You can thank me when Decimus is running out of moves, she said. Start grinding. The thorn moss needs to be fresh for the 2nd application. He crossed to the workbench, picked up the spare pestle, and they worked side by side in the cottage at the edge of the thornwood, while the silver bell flowers bloomed continuously outside the window, and the forest waited, as it had always been waiting, with enormous patience, for the pieces it had set in motion to arrive at the place it had intended. The court of Ravenswood was not what she had expected, and she had expected considerable things. She had expected a castle, the heavy stone and imposing architecture of power that wanted to be seen. What Ravenswood was, instead, was woven. The great hall rose from the living forest itself, its walls the trunks of elder trees grown together over centuries, their canopy the ceiling, their roots the floor, flagstone and root and earth merged in a way that spoke of magic so old it had forgotten it was magic and had simply become how things were. The court had not been built in Thornwood. The Thornwood had grown into the court, over time, until the distinction between structure and forest ceased to mean anything. It was, she thought, walking through the great entrance with Aldred's loyalists behind them, the most alive building she had ever been in. And it knew her. She felt it the moment they crossed the threshold. A recognition running through the roots beneath her feet. The same quality of attention she felt from the Thornwood near her cottage, but amplified, intensified, the awareness of the whole forest concentrated in this place. It moved through her like a warm current, like a confirmation, like arriving somewhere she had always been headed. She had dressed practically, because she was Clarice, and she dressed practically for everything. Dark wool. Her grandmother's silver thread belt, which she had stopped dismissing as decorative the moment she understood what it actually was. Seraphel's compact seal, wearable, the compact's authority embodied in the weaving. Her herbalist's satchel, packed with specific intent. She had spent two nights reading, working, and preparing, and the satchel reflected all of it. Aldred beside her occupied an entirely different category. The loyalist had brought his court clothes, and the transformation was something she was still adjusting to, not because it changed who he was, but because it revealed who he also was, simultaneously, layered over the man she'd watched split wood and tend wounds and stand at her cottage window before dawn. He wore the Ravenswood crest with the authority of someone who had worn it since birth, and intended to wear it for centuries more. He moved through the forest hall with a sovereignty so natural it appeared biological. "I found this man bleeding in the mud," she reminded herself. "He sat down because I told him to." The hall was full. The full assembly of the Ravenswood court filled the tiered gallery spaces. Fey nobles in the archaic formal wear of their bloodlines, wolf-blooded courtiers whose bodies registered Aldred's entrance with the involuntary responses of pack instinct, emissaries from the six border territories that owed the Ravenswood seat their fealty, and had evidently decided that this particular assembly required their personal presence. Decimus stood at the far end of the hall in front of the vacant seat, dressed in the court's black and looking entirely as though he had arranged this room and this assembly and this moment with the specific intent it now served. He had. He had arranged all of it, and he was standing in it with the composed satisfaction of a man watching his work complete itself. He looked at Aldred. He looked at Clarice. His satisfaction developed an edge. "Aldred of Ravenswood," he said, with the formal intonation of the court. "The assembly acknowledges your presence and confirms the sovereignty challenge filed under the old compact. The three proofs are required. Alpha dominance by display or challenge, acknowledged by the assembly. Fey lineage confirmation, acknowledged by the eldest noble present. And the mate bond seal, presented before the assembly, affirmed willingly by the mortal-born fated mate, witnessed and recorded." He paused there, looked at Clarice directly. And there was the trap. Not the first requirement. Not the second. Those Aldred would meet without difficulty. The wolves in the room were already responding to him, their bodies deciding before their minds caught up, and the eldest noble was a woman with 300 years in her eyes who was already moving to the front of the gallery. The third. The mate bond seal, affirmed willingly, in front of the full assembly, a mortal woman affirming before a fey court, binding herself to it. If she hesitated, showed any uncertainty, any reluctance, any shadow of doubt, Decimus would use it. Would call the bond deficient, the consent compromised, would file for invalidation before the hour was out. And if she affirmed, she was bound. To Ravenswood. to the court, to a world she had spent 24 years at the edge of and never inside. He had built a box with two exits that both led to him. Clarice looked at Decimus for a long, even moment. Then she looked at Aldred. He was watching her with the most defenseless expression she had ever seen on him, all of it stripped back, the sovereignty and the authority and the careful management, and underneath it, simply a man who had made a choice to mean what he'd said and was waiting to see what she would do with it. He would not ask her. She could see that. He would not influence this. He had told her the choice was hers, and he had meant every word, and he was standing in front of his full court and his throne and 4 centuries of his family's legacy and not asking her for a single thing. The decision was already made. It had been made in a cottage kitchen at dawn, and it had been made in a garden with silver bell flowers leaning toward a man who didn't yet know she was watching, and it had been made 11 seconds at the edge of a road in the rain before she crossed it. She stepped forward. "I affirm," she said, clearly and without preamble, freely, without compulsion, without obligation, without prophecy as justification, as my own choice, and... She opened her satchel. Produced the vial she had prepared 2 nights ago at the workbench while Aldred slept. The mate bond sealing compound from Seraphel's grimoire, the one the old Thornwood herbalist tradition had used for 4 centuries before the Ravenswood court existed. Silver lit inside the glass. Undeniable. She held it up so the assembly could see. "This is a Thornwood hereditary sealing compound, made according to the compact my ancestor established with the forest 2 centuries before this court was built. I invoke my right under that compact to seal the bond according to my own tradition, rather than the court's procedural requirements. The seal is valid under the older jurisdiction, and supersedes the court's procedure. Any challenge to that supersession would require the assembly to rule on whether this court's procedures hold precedence over a compact 2 centuries its senior." The hall was absolutely quiet. "The bond seal requires no compounds," Decimus said, and the pleasant tone had developed something underneath it. "The bond seal requires my willing participation and confirmation," Clarice said. "I'm confirming. The method is mine to choose. You're welcome to contest the jurisdiction. It's a fascinating legal question. It might take years to resolve. In the meantime, the assembly has witnessed the affirmation." She didn't look at Decimus again. She looked at the eldest noble, 3 centuries of Fey lineage standing in the front gallery, and held the vial steady. The elder moved forward, performed the lineage acknowledgement, hands open, the old language spoken in the 3 specific registers that made it binding, and it was done. The alpha display happened before it was formally requested. The wolves in the room had been deciding since Aldred walked in, and the decision arrived collectively, without ceremony. 40 wolf-blooded courtiers in various stages of the involuntary bow, acknowledging an alpha they felt before they processed him, and the formal challenge, offered by Decimus's own deputy and immediately declined, simply confirmed what the room had already decided. Decimus stepped down from the position before the seat, not immediately. He stood there for several seconds, and she watched him perform the calculation, the rapid, meticulous assessment of whether there was a remaining move, and the acknowledgement that there wasn't one, and the way that acknowledgement arranged itself into something that was not acceptance, but was the thing that looked like acceptance from the outside while feeling completely different from within. He stepped down. The assembly shifted around the new center of gravity, the way water shifted around a stone placed in it, completely, inevitably, without drama. Aldred of Ravenswood took his seat. Afterwards, in a small stone chamber off the Great Hall, Clarice sat on a bench and let her hands shake for approximately 90 seconds, because she had been entirely steady through all of it, and now her body wanted its accounting. Aldred sat beside her, not crowding, close. "You prepared for that," he said. "I prepared for every version of it I could build," she said. "Decimus is meticulous. You have to be more meticulous than Decimus. I had 2 nights and my grandmother's index. The 2-century supersession. Real. In the back of the grimoire, under compact notes and handwriting so small I nearly missed it. My grandmother hid the most important things in the least obvious places because she understood that obvious places were the first ones searched. He was quiet. You've been carrying the tools to do this your entire life without knowing what you were carrying them for, he said. I'm beginning to think that was rather the point, she said. He took her hand, not formally. Not as a king acknowledging a consort before the court, simply laced his fingers through hers and held on with the particular quality of someone holding something they had not expected to be permitted to hold and intended to do so with care. The stone of the chamber was cold, his hand was cool. And Clarice felt, in the ancient living court of Ravenswood, with a kingdom redistributed around them, and Decimus somewhere behind them, recalculating, entirely and precisely like herself. Which was, she had decided, the only thing she'd ever really needed. 3 weeks after the assembly, Aldred left. Not without warning. He told her clearly, the morning of his departure, standing in the east courtyard of Ravenswood in the gray early light that came through the tree ceiling in long slanted shafts, already dressed for travel, already carrying the particular expression of a man who has decided something difficult and is committed to communicating it honestly despite the cost. The 6 border courts require my presence in person. The loyalty arrangements Decimus made in my absence, the ones that were technically legal and practically corrosive, need to be unwound properly. Some of the territory claims require mediation. There are relationships that were managed while I was missing that need to be personally renegotiated. He said it carefully. Factually. With the tone of someone giving a full and accurate account. How long? Months. Possibly longer. 6 months would be the optimistic estimate. Clarice looked at him in the pale morning light. You're telling me this at dawn in a courtyard instead of last night. Last night I couldn't say it, he said, quietly. And it needed to be said clearly, without the context of the room and the evening and... He stopped, restarted. You are not required to wait. The bond is sealed. Your compact is recorded in the Ravenswood archive. Your status under the court is unassailable. Nothing Decimus does or attempts can alter it. Your grandmother's lands are protected. You can go home. You can live your life exactly as you lived it before any of this. I am not... Aldred, she said, I am not going to be the thing that removes your choices from you. Not again. Not ever. Whatever you decide. Whatever you... Aldred. He stopped. She looked at him. This man she had found bleeding in her road, who had sat down when she told him to, who had eaten everything she offered and mended her shutter hinge and known her name before she gave it, who had told her the truth in pieces and then trusted her with the whole of it, who had stood in his own court beside her without asking her for a single thing. Are you coming back? He looked at her with the expression of a man hearing a question that redefined the shape of the conversation he thought he was having. Yes. No elaboration, no condition, just yes, with the full weight of a man who had spent his life having his certainties stripped from him and was offering this one with everything he had. Then I'll be in the Thornwood, she said. Don't be dramatic about it. Go renegotiate your kingdoms. She went home. The cottage received her back without comment, the way it always had. Walls that held warmth better than physics explained, the particular quality of light through the east window in the late mornings, the smell of dried herbs and old wood and the loam of the thornwood that she had been breathing her entire life and could not sleep without. She restocked her shelves, checked her stores for winter, tended the garden where the silver bell flowers bloomed continuously now in all seasons, which she had decided to simply accept as a permanent feature of her life rather than an ongoing anomaly. She made house calls to Ashenvale, where old Renwick had heard rumors and looked at her with something between awe and the particular suspicion of a man who has been underestimating someone for years and is not yet comfortable with the adjustment. He paid her in coin from that point on. She didn't mention it. Letters came, Not formal correspondence. She had half expected formal correspondence, the official kind, dispatched through court channels with seals and ceremony. What came instead were letters in Aldred's hand, which was precise and smaller than she expected, and occasionally had small marginal additions that read like the thoughts he'd had after he'd already said the main thing. Short letters. Factual. Court politics rendered in spare, dry prose that occasionally broke into something almost sardonic, usually about Decimus, who had retained his court position through a technicality Aldred outlined in one letter with the resigned humor of someone who had long since accepted that Decimus was going to be a permanent, low-level weather system in his political landscape. There were questions about herbalism. She answered them in detail, because detail was how she answered everything, and then added at the ends of her answers observations about the thornwood and the cottage, and what the winter light was doing in the garden, which were not strictly relevant to his questions, and which she included anyway. Her letters were considerably longer than his. She was not apologetic about this. He returned in 7 weeks. Not months. 7 weeks. The middle of a clear winter morning, with the light coming through the thornwood canopy in cold golden shafts and the silver bell flowers doing something emphatic and luminous along the cottage wall. She heard the wolf before she heard anything else, the large dark shape at the tree line that resolved in the space of a breath into a man walking up the cottage lane with the particular gait of someone who has been moving fast for a very long time and has only just, in the last 100 yards, permitted themselves to slow down. She had the door open before he reached it. You finished early. I renegotiated faster than I projected. By 5 months? The ghost of the smile that was becoming less of a ghost. I had incentive. She stepped back to let him in. He stopped in the doorway for a moment, stood in the threshold the way he'd stood at thresholds before, taking inventory of his own internal state. She watched him do it without rushing it. The cottage smelled of dried thornbell and cold river clay, and the particular winter mix she'd been compounding that morning. His eyes went around the room, the workbench, the jars, the charms above the door, the silver bell on the windowsill, with the expression of something that had been away and was making sure everything was still where it belonged. "There is something I want to ask you," he said. She moved to the workbench, picked up the morning's work, and began grinding, because she thought he might say it more accurately if she wasn't watching him directly, and she wanted the most accurate version of whatever he was about to say. "The Ravenswood Court has a consort seat. It's not ceremonial. I want to be clear about that. The original compact built it with real authority. The Thornwood lineage consorts historically governed the border territories directly, including all land and compact management, which includes the territories where your grandmother's land sits, where your cottage sits." She set down the pestle. "What are you asking?" He came to stand behind her at the workbench, the same distance he always kept, close enough to matter, never close enough to crowd, the specific distance of a man who had learned, late and painfully, the difference between presence and pressure. "I am asking because I want to," he said, "and only because I want to. Not because of the prophecy, which is fulfilled and done. Not because of the bond, which is sealed and doesn't require anything further from either of you. Not because of the court or the compact or anything that could be framed as obligation or strategy or use." She could hear it in his voice, the precise, deliberate dismantling of every possible alternative explanation. He was removing them one by one in advance, the way he'd removed the boards of the shutter and fixed the hinge. Methodical and thorough, because he was a man who fixed things completely or not at all. "I crossed 6 kingdoms in 7 weeks because I wanted to come back to you, not to Ravenswood, not to the restored title, to you, in this cottage with these herbs, arguing about shelf organization and writing me letters 4 times longer than mine, because you are constitutionally incapable of saying a thing incompletely. He paused. "I have spent 4 centuries making choices that were required of me. Duty, bloodline, obligation. The first choice I have ever made entirely for myself was deciding to mean what I said when I told you the choice was yours. I would like to make a second one. I would like to ask you." She turned around. He was standing in her cottage kitchen, this man who was also a wolf king and a fey prince and 4 centuries of sovereign inheritance, wearing the particular expression of someone standing at the edge of the only thing that had ever genuinely frightened them. He reached into his coat, placed on the workbench between them, carefully, her grandmother's ring. She recognized it immediately, the simple silver band with the thornwood compact seal pressed into it, the one Seraphel had worn every day of her life and that had been absent from her hand when they buried her. Clarice had assumed it lost, had assumed it gone with the woman who wore it. "It was in the Ravenswood archive," he said. "Given there as surety for the compact 200 years ago, I had it retrieved and restored." He was quiet for a moment. "I want to return it to you. And I want to ask you, with nothing withheld, no remaining unknowns, no prophecy, and no obligation between us, will you choose this? Not because the forest chose it, and not because you owe anything to anyone. Because you want to." She looked at the ring. She looked at him. She thought about her grandmother, who had stood at the edge of the thornwood at 23 and made a pact with a forest and carried it in silence for decades so that Clarice could carry it forward. She thought about a prophecy that had taken the shape of a bleeding stranger at the foot of her road. She thought about 11 seconds in the rain and the choice she'd made before she even knew there was one to make. She thought about what it meant to be chosen and what it meant to choose and how they were different. And how, in the right circumstances, between the right people, they could become the same thing. She picked up the ring. It was warm, warmer than the room, warmer than the workbench it had been resting on, warm the way things were warm when they'd been held for a long time by someone who loved them. "You should know some things," she said. "I expected conditions," he said, and there was something in his voice that might have been the precursor to laughter. "The cottage stays. The practice stays. I am the herbalist of Ashenvale, and I am not explaining to old Renwick that he needs to find someone else for his fever tonic, because he will manage it badly and I will hear about it for years. The Thornwood is my home, and I will not be extracted from it wholesale into the court." "Obviously," he said. "And if you ever, ever approach a political problem without briefing me in advance again, I will solve it myself with whatever resources I have available, and I will do it so efficiently and so completely that you will spend the rest of your considerable lifespan dealing with the minor embarrassment of having tried to handle it alone. That is a completely fair condition, and I accept it. And you are going to learn to actually sleep, full nights. I have compounds for that, and I will not hesitate." He took her face in his hands. "Clarice," he said. And her name in his voice was what it had always been, careful and precise and held with the particular quality of something he understood the value of and was not going to mishandle. "Is that a yes?" She slid the ring onto her finger. Outside the window, the silver bell flowers bloomed all at once, every single one on every vine along every wall of the cottage, simultaneously in the cold winter morning light, white and luminous and absolutely absurd and exactly right, the forest offering its opinion, as always. "It's a yes," she said. "Now sit down. You look like you haven't slept since you left." He sat down because she told him to, because he chose to, because, and this was the thing that mattered, the thing underneath all the prophecy and the curse and the kingdoms and the compact. He had always, from the moment he'd opened his silver eyes in her back room, been choosing her, and she had been choosing him. 11 seconds at the edge of a road in the rain, and everything after, and they were home. The end. She was a herbalist. He was a king. She found him dying in her road, and she chose him before she knew what he was, and he had been choosing her longer than either of them understood. If this story landed in your chest even a little, subscribe. Drop a like so Clarice and Aldred know their story found the right people. More tales are already growing in the roots of the Thornwood, and you want to be here when they surface. Tap the bell. Subscribe. You've earned it. So has Clarice.